from the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We bring you a special edition of the program today. The New York Times plays a special role in American journalism. Its news coverage shapes not only how its readers think about the world, but how other news organizations all over the globe cover events. That unique position means the Times' achievements have outsized impacts, as do its mistakes. It also means that the person at the top of the masthead is constantly under a microscope. So on today's show, we're pleased to be joined by that person. Dean Baquet has been executive editor of the New York Times since 2014. Now 63, he got his start after dropping out of college to become a reporter in New Orleans in the 1970s. He went on to do a number of jobs at the Chicago Tribune, the Los Angeles Times, and the New York Times. And along the way, he's won many awards, including a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting, and most recently, a 2019 honor medal from the Missouri School of Journalism. Dean Baquet, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. You came of age in the 70s in Louisiana. What got you interested in being a reporter?
You know, it was an accident. I had never been outside of Louisiana when I went away to college in New York. I'd never been on an airplane. And I was really homesick after my sophomore year. So I went back to New Orleans, got a job at the afternoon paper, mainly because it seemed like an interesting thing to do. And I was homesick. I wanted to be home. It was easy to get internships in those days. And I just fell in love with it. The characters, the noise, the sense that it was a job that had a mission. This is in the 70s, so the world was still in some turmoil. It just felt bigger than me. It just felt compelling.
And I understand you are actually credited with getting one of the greatest quotes from a politician in the last 25 or 30 years from Edwin Edwards. Tell us about him.
So I was Edwin Edwards had been the colorful governor of Louisiana. He was governor for 8 years, and he had to sit out for four because you couldn't serve three terms. And then he came roaring back. And I was covering his campaign for the New Orleans paper, the Times-Picayune. And it was the two of us on the back of the bus. And the a poll had just come out showing him with 60% of the vote. So I said, Governor, any way you lose this election. And right off the top of his head, he says, Dean, only way I lose this election is if I'm caught in bed with a dead girl or a live boy, which was like electrifying. The one bit of one sidelight. I wrote the story. There was no internet then. So I dictated it from a payphone on the side of the road, picked up the paper, and the next day it wasn't there. Because an editor thought it was tasteless, which it was. So I went back and put it in for the next edition.
Well, let's fast forward just a bit. You went on to work a number of jobs. You ultimately became the editor of the Los Angeles Times. And then you were actually fired quite publicly from that job. Talk to us about that episode.
I thought it was a difficult economic time for newspapers. But I honestly thought that the LA Times owners, the Tribune Company, I thought they were cutting it so deep that it would never be able to be a great news organization. I also thought it was bad business, and I told them that. I told them that when a new publisher came in. I said, if you're going to continue to cut the paper, tell me now, because I can leave quietly. And to be honest, I thought he misled me a little bit. They continued to cut. It was too much. As evidence of how big a deal it was, his predecessor, Jeff Johnson, the publisher, also got fired because he thought the cuts were too deep and was going to hurt the LA Times as a business. I just thought we were, and to be honest, I think history proved us right, that its circulation kept declining. There's a new owner who's reviving it, but I thought it was short-sighted business and bad for journalism.
Well, I mean, much of the traditional news, at least newspaper industry, I mean, the business model has just been in the toilet for quite some time. Yeah. Journalists have been getting laid off left and right, newspapers closing from local newspapers to metro dailies. The Times has been succeeding. For a while, it seemed like they might be hurt by these same forces, but it's bounced back. I think the latest data is that there are 3.8 million digital subscriptions now.
If you add in everything, it's close to 5 million.
Okay, including the crossword and the cooking on, these other products the Times sells. So what is this new revenue? What has it allowed you to do? Like, what do you see expanding as it continues
to grow? First off,
it's
allowed us to make the core of the paper better. You know, we hired in the Washington Bureau. We hired investigative reporters. It just took the foot off the neck. But it also allowed us to build an investigative video operation. It also allowed us to create a weekly television show, a podcast. It just it just allowed the newsroom to be creative, and it takes a lot of creativity to cut. So to suddenly have the breathing room to add and to build has been terrific for the New York Times.
Well, what would you say, like, what would you say going forward, where are some areas where you'd like to invest more?
More investigative reporting, even stronger international reporting. I'd like to figure out a handful of states like California and Texas where we can even increase our footprint. I think the goal is to create, my fantasy is that there's as high a percentage of as possible of stories in the New York Times you can't find anyplace else. But I'd like to be out in the country more. I'd like to even have more national bureaus. I'd like to just be out and about.
Well, as I mentioned, you've led the Times for the past 5 years. How do you think that you've changed it? I mean, sort of changes to technology aside, like, where do you think you can point and say, this is where I made my mark, and this is something that Dean Baquet did that if somebody else was in charge wouldn't have happened?
I'll say it with a certain amount of humility, because people should judge you and you shouldn't judge yourself, but I think I made it a great investigative paper, which was my own background, and I think I made it a paper that does enterprise better than it's ever done. But the second thing is, I think I made it a paper that I hope people would say, I made it a paper that's not afraid to fail. We try stuff. We try big stuff. We screw up sometimes. I think I've made it a paper where the dominant ethos when people have innovative ideas is yes. That's my goal.
Well, let me just ask you about sort of the flip side of the Times success. I mean, there is research that shows as subscriptions to the Times have grown, mm-hmm. subscriptions to local news, metro news sources are declining. I mean, is this something that concerns you? And if so, is it something that you can actually do something about? Obviously, people only have a limited amount of money they're willing to spend on the news.
Yeah. I don't think our rise has come at the cost of local news organizations. I think local news organizations are struggling because their economic model is different. They don't charge as much. They don't have the scale we have. But I think that's a crisis in journalism, the decline of local news. We can't fix all of it. I can't cover the school board in Edison, New Jersey, or in Orange County. I do hope we can partner with local news organizations more. We've done some of that. I grew up in local journalism. I feel a deep loyalty and a commitment to the profession surviving. There's a limit, but I'd love to do more.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking to the executive editor of the New York Times, Dean Baquet. Baquet led the Times newsroom since 2014, and before that, he held the number two job under former executive editor Jill Abramson. Well, Dean, if I could just turn you to sort of current news. As I mentioned in my introduction, being at the top of the masthead of the New York Times means that you're constantly under the microscope, and there's always controversy swirling around the Times and its coverage. Back in August, there was a big controversy about a Times headline after the mass shootings in Dayton and El Paso, Texas. Yeah. The headline, of course, was Trump urges unity versus racism. Many people felt that was inappropriate given the president's past rhetoric, that the El Paso shooter appeared to be targeting Mexicans. I mean, I understand that you came out, you corrected that headline, you changed it. But I guess sort of the bigger question is that there was a lot of pressure applied to the Times through subscribers saying they're going to cancel their subscription as a result of this. Do you see that as changing sort of how you do your job?
First off, it was a bad headline, and we changed it because it was a bad headline. I do think the biggest change in the economics of newspapers like the New York Times is that instead of getting most of our revenue from advertising, we're increasingly getting our revenue from our readers. Which means that our readers, you know, are active and they critique us. And I think that's important. I don't think my job is to always give the readers what they want. Sometimes I just disagree with the readers. But I think it's a better business, to be frank, having the readers get to tell you things and communicate with you and to make demands of you than it was in the old days when it was the local advertisers.
Well, I want to ask you as well about another area of controversy, and that's the way that the Times uses the word lie in news stories. And that was something that struck me soon after President Trump's election. I think it was in 2016, at least for me, that was the first time that I had seen the Times saying the president lied about something. And this was with regard to Trump saying that he had evidence about President Obama's birth certificate saying he wasn't an American, words to that effect. Obviously, I mean, just from the Washington Post, they've counted 12,000 false or misleading statements by the president. It seems like the Times has very rarely used the word lie, and in fact has basically stopped.
Yeah. Well, no, I wouldn't say stop. We've used it. We were the first to use it. We've used it more than the Post or any of our competitors. I don't want the word to lose its value or power. We used it when it was absolutely clear that the president's motivation was to lie. I don't want the word lie. I mean, people we cover lie all the time. I mean, if you open the door, so the first time an NFL running back, gains 150 yards and says, I would not have been able to do this without my line. Well, that's not true. Or the first time a businessman says that we missed our earnings by 4%. I mean, where's the limit? There's lying all across the spectrum. I think that it's a very powerful word. It should be used when you know the person knew it was a lie, when you have some evidence inside their head that they knew it. And I think I want to sign off on it every time we use it. And we've used it a handful of times with regards to Donald Trump.
I mean, I guess the criticism is that given all these other instances, I mean, Trump said the Obama administration also separated children from their families at the border. He said
except that's true,
Alabama. Well, I read in the New York Times that he kept families together.
Yeah.
Ilhan Omar partied on the anniversary of 9/11. Obviously, the flurry of statements coming from Trump. when you refer to these as claims without evidence, doesn't it in some ways minimize them?
I don't think so. Look, I think my honest view, is that the best way to capture when a politician says something inappropriate, wrong, or that's false, is to lay out why. I think if people read the word lie and they stop. In fact, the funny thing is when we've used the word lie, people were more focused on us and our decision to use the word lie. They don't even remember when we used it. I think the thing to do is to lay out what a politician says and use lie in extraordinary circumstances when you know it was a conspiratorial attempt to not tell the truth. I just think language, the politicization of words like lie and even racist, which has also come up from some of our critics, I think the most powerful thing to do is to say what the person said and explain why it's wrong.
I'm glad you raised that word racist, because there was also a lot of discussion, particularly after the president told it was for congresswomen, all women of color, that they should go back to where you came from.
Yeah.
The Times, I think it referred to the phrasing as a racist trope.
Why not just
label that as racist?
I think it's the same thing. You know, I think, look, one thing I will say to some of my critics, I'm a black man who grew up in the 1960s in the South. I know racism when I hear it. I know the power of the word. But my own view is that it's far more powerful to quote the person, lay out the evidence that it's not true, than to let your newspaper get caught up in the political debate over the use of a word. I just think that's more powerful.
I mean, I guess part of the argument is that there's a double standard for the president, in that if David Duke said it, it would be labeled as racist, but when the president says it,
Duke said it, you probably wouldn't even have to label it. You would say David Duke said, what he says is so outrageous. But I don't know. I guess I think that we have gotten to the point where there are these debates over the use of individual words. And to be frank, they've politicized the words, and it's the facts that matter the most. I have gone back and I've read the greatest coverage of the civil rights movement in making these decisions. And the most powerful coverage, I mean, I read a portrait of Philadelphia, Mississippi after the deaths of the three civil rights workers. And the magazine piece that I read, which happened to be by Joseph Lelyville from the Times, was a portrait of a racist city. Did never use the word racist. It begins with a guy sitting on his front porch as a black man walks by and he shouts at him, "Hey, boy." That is the most powerful portrait. If that story had begun with "the people of Philadelphia, Mississippi are racist," I wouldn't have read the second paragraph. It was this rich portrait in the own word, in the words of the people, and I thought that was much more powerful.
Isn't the context a bit different, though, when you're covering sort of daily political news than from when you're writing a portrait or feature?
Yeah.
And the reader needs to know, you know, sort of soon. They can't wait for the 12th paragraph to say these were, you know, such and such is considered a racist trope. I think that's probably the counter argument there.
Yeah, no, I by the way, I should say, I get the counter argument. This is not an easy call. I get the counter argument, and I don't think it's ridiculous. I think it's compelling. I just have a different view.
Well, I wanted to ask you as well, do you sense that within the New York Times newsroom, and of course we're talking about this because the way I think the New York Times talks about these issues influences the way other news organizations do and influences the way a lot of people do. But within journalism, within your newsroom, do you see that there are generational differences between how people perceive this?
Yeah. What's going on in newsrooms now is not unlike what happened in newsrooms in the 1960s. Again, I told you I went back and read the history. So think of the 1960s. New York Times, Washington Post are all covering the war in Vietnam. The newsroom filled with guys in that period who are in their 20s, who are eligible for the draft or who know people in the military. There's tremendous tension in the newsroom. This is a little bit like that. There's a generational shift. There are younger journalists who come into the newsroom who have a different set of beliefs than the beliefs of the older journalists. To be frank, I think that tension's good. A newsroom is supposed to, if a newsroom is covering a tumultuous society, the newsroom should look a little bit tumultuous itself. And society's having tension over all these issues. So there's there's very much a generational divide. And my goal is to hold on to what I think are the bedrock principles of the New York Times, but to also listen to the younger journalists because they have things to teach me.
Well, I wanted to ask you about a couple other issues as well, but in particular, so mostly what we've been talking about is criticisms of the Times from the left. Obviously, the Times has been criticized a few times from the right.
A couple times.
As well. specifically, you know, one of the things, I mean, we could talk about the validity of some of those different concerns, but ultimately, if you look at polling data from Gallup and other organizations, trust in the U.S. news media overall is very low, near record lows, especially among Republicans. It's something like 15% or 16% say they trust the news media.
Yeah.
I imagine trust for the New York Times might be even lower among Republicans.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is the approach that we've been following, is it working?
It's troublesome. First off, we have a president of the United States who has beat up the press in the most incendiary way possible. He has called us enemies of the people. He's called us enemies of the state. He's accused us of making things up. That has contributed to this erosion. It's not just that. It happened before that. But I think that the president's attacks, of course, hurt us with Republicans and hurt us with people in general. I mean, the president has a huge megaphone. How do we combat that? You know, we need to be more transparent with people. We need to own up to our mistakes. I mean, when we wrote a bad headline, I think I admitted it within 2 seconds. That's new. Newspapers used to say, we don't want to hear about it. I think we have to be more transparent about how we make decisions. I think we have to own up to what, there's so much that we assume people understood about us. We thought they understood datelines. We thought they gave us the benefit of the doubt when we, you know, outed the occupation of the whistleblower in the current story. We thought they understood us. And in the absence of defending ourselves and the president and others attacking us, I think we now need to stand up for ourselves a little bit and be more open.
Well, I mean, I think the critique goes deeper than that, in that it's that the Times itself is staffed by liberals from the coast who just don't come from the same background and share the same values as many other Americans do, and that in some ways there is, you know, there's this discussion of objectivity, but people are ultimately influenced by what's in their hearts and what's in their values, and that is reflected in the Times
though I actually think I actually think that the staff of the New York Times needs to be more diverse in many ways. But I actually think if people came into the New York Times, they would find surprises. I mean, I'm certainly did not grow up as a member of the East Coast elite. I grew up in a very Catholic family in the Deep South. 2 weeks ago, we ran a front page first person piece by our Pentagon correspondent, who who described his life covering the war in Afghanistan as a longtime member of the military. It's a little more diverse than people think. It needs to be more diverse, but it needs to be more diverse than people. It's more diverse than people think.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. I'm joined today by Dean Baquet, the executive editor of The New York Times. If you're interested in more Global Journalist, you can visit us online at globaljournalist.org. You can also follow us on Facebook or Twitter, subscribe to the video cast of this program on YouTube, or get our podcast from iTunes or Spotify. Well, Dean Baquet, we only have a few minutes left. I want to ask you about an op-ed recently written by the Times publisher, your boss, Arthur Sulzberger. And in this op-ed, he was sort of decrying the state of press freedom around the world, but I thought he made some very pointed criticisms about the United States as well. And I think his larger point was that press freedom can only exist in societies where the government itself values press freedom. Yeah. And he was expressing the feeling that that is increasingly not the case in the United States. What do you see?
I see a president who not only attacks the New York Times and other news organizations in the United States, but on foreign soil. I see a president who gives other world leaders almost permission to look down on the press. I see a president who's made the phrase fake news an acceptable and common phrase in the world. And I think that, and I see, you know, an administration that is trying to undermine the institutions that are supposed to be independent of its power. So I agree with the publisher. I think that those actions weaken the way the press is regarded and can operate around the world, and that scares me.
And I mean, I guess just to sort of further that point, I mean, as you rightly point out, I mean, the climate has been changing for journalists all around the world. But also, you know, as you mentioned, these larger freedoms within the United States have been declining for the last several years. How can the press not be regarded as being sort of an enemy of the president when he's putting you in that position? I know the Times has resisted this label as sort of the paper of the resistance to Trump. But as the U.S. sort of creeps away from some of its democratic ideals, does the Times not automatically become, and the media become closer to the resistance?
No, I don't think so. My own view, for all the things I just said about the president, my own view is true independence means being independent of everybody. True independence means being independent of the powerful forces on the left and the powerful forces on the right. True independence means asking hard questions of the Democratic candidates, as well as hard questions. True independence means you do not align yourself with anybody. And to be honest, I think to align yourself with anybody, so here's how that works. Anybody who reads history knows how that works. You become part of the resistance. Eventually in the United States, the resistance wins. Then you're just the chump to the people you aligned yourself with. And I think that's equally unhealthy.
I wanted to ask you about the Times coverage of the 2016 presidential elections. Hillary Clinton wrote a book in which she excoriated the Times coverage for she felt like overemphasizing the scandal about her emails and whether or not she had stored classified emails improperly. Republicans and President Trump also were very critical of the Times coverage. What lessons do you think you've taken away from that? How does that shape your coverage as you look towards impeachment in 2020?
I don't think, by the way, we overcovered her emails. I mean, the director of the FBI launched the public investigation of her emails, and I think we had to cover that. But put that aside, I don't think we captured or understood just how much anxiety there was in the country. I don't think we understood the combination of the fallout from the economic crisis, the disenfranchisement of people who, you know, are freaked out in the age of social media. And I don't think we had a handle on it. I think we relied too much on polls. And I just don't think we had our, you know, we had our arms around the country. And I think that my goal this time is to do a much better job understanding what it was that caused the country to elect this very remarkable president. I think we got to do a better job. I don't think we did a great job doing that.
Well, to come full circle, so you came of age during Watergate. Do you think it would be possible for reporters today to be lionized in the same way that Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein were for reporting government wrongdoing back then?
I do. These things do go in cycles, right? You know, look, after we broke the Harvey Weinstein story and we started the whole Me Too movement, right after that, I got more emails saying that we were the best thing since sliced bread ever. The two reporters would show up at events and people would stand up and applaud. I think that people are still willing. It's a very partisan time, but I think reporters can, in fact, do the kind of work that garners those kinds of accolades. It should not be the goal of a life's goal. Yes, of course I do. I think that. I think all institutions, not just the press, all institutions have garnered a certain amount of mistrust in the era we're in. And I think we need to understand that.
I wanted to ask you as well about this network of pro-Trump conservatives that have said they're investigating the social media backgrounds, the history of staff at the Times and CNN in an effort to find inappropriate things they may have said on social media previously. Do you see this as a case of turnabout is fair play, that since the press is doing this to politicians themselves, or is this intimidation or a bit of both?
It's intimidation. I don't see it as turnabout is fair play. Look, we do that, and I know people will think this is arrogant, but we do it for a journalistic purpose. We do it to understand people's motivations. First off, the only people they're outing are like...
I mean, they would argue they're doing it to discover your own motivations too, right?
But they're outing third or fourth tier staffers and then elevating their status and lying about their status. That's sort of... Look, I'm fair game. If somebody... And I don't tweet. If somebody were to find something in my social media account, I think that's more fair. The third, fourth, fifth, sixth ranking guy on the politics desk. That's just intimidation.
Well, we're growing short on time. As I mentioned, the Times has made progress in diversifying its newsroom. I think it's about half female now within the New York Times newsroom. It's about 30% people of color. So it's fairly reflective in some ways of the population as a whole. You mentioned there's more to be done. Where do you see that?
I would like more people who were educated and raised in other parts of the country. I don't think we have enough religious diversity. You know, if you put out a newspaper in Manhattan, you don't get a lot of people for whom religion is a very powerful part of their lives. Manhattan's a very secular place. I would like there to be, I grew up in the Catholic Church. I'm not particularly religious now. I'd like there to be more people on staff who have, you know, for whom religion is an important part of their lives. I'd like to have more people on staff who grew up in small towns. I'd like to have that. The diversity comes in different ways, and I'd like to have more of that on the staff.
That's going to do it for this edition of Global Journalist. Thanks very much to Dean McKay for joining us.
Thank you.
Global Journalist is a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Our thanks again to Dean McKay for joining us today. Our producer this week is Trevor Hook. Takiya Thomas is audio engineer. Kathy Kiley is executive editor. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.